Disc 7.
Love, God, compassion, guru, and consciousness are examples. They're all very tempting havens, very safe and snug at first. But none of them are final destinations, as anyone who stops on them will eventually come to realize. But that's no reason not to stop on them. Life is not a race, and the only destination is the journey itself. "That's what it is," he answers me. "Freedom from bondage. Breaking free of the chains that enslave us and keep us thinking we're just lowly biological life forms when in truth we're divine beings. Just like you talking about the guy in Plato's cave releasing the chains that bind him to ignorance. That's just perfect. That's exactly what it is. That's what Maharishi means." I don't have a formal teaching as such, but I know what the Maharishi does, and I know that he has gone to great lengths to protect it from exactly this sort of inevitable distortion. It's no different from the children's game of operator, where a story is passed down the line from person to person, and then the resulting story is compared to the original, and everyone marvels at how little they have in common. No light, no matter how pure, can pass through so many filters and end up anything but murky and dark. If I were attached to results, I might think of this book as my legacy, my gift to future generations that will reflect my teachings as pristinely 1,000 years from now as it will the day it goes to press. But I don't have any thought like that. This isn't my teaching. It's the only teaching, and this is just my way of delivering it. If we were to strip out the excess in this book, it would probably be 1/10 the size and would be just my way of saying what any enlightened guy would say. It's not personal. It's not regional or ethnic. It's not a Western Christian's version as opposed to the Inuit shaman's version or the Tibetan Buddhist version. It's not on that level. What's true is true regardless of region, culture, planet, galaxy, or dimension. It is what it is, and I'm just the guy who happens to be saying it right now. If you put 10 books by 10 enlightened people together and stripped out the excess, they'd all be the same. That's how it is at the core. The reason for all the excess is that there's no saying it directly because there's no it. So everything has to be communicated indirectly. What it's not, what it's like, never what it is. I observe with interest the fact that Chris's insights into the nature of delusion avail him not in the least in his bid for freedom. Ironically, he is imprisoned by his own views of freedom. He does not possess his views. They possess him. All his knowledge and his urgent desire to express it and to have it validated stems directly from his ego's need for reassurance that he is ahead of the curve, which, of course, stems directly from his fear that he is well behind it. While it may be interesting for me to dissect someone's fear patterns and see how they reinforce the hold of ego, it would probably not be useful for me to point it out to Chris. He would not be receptive. His ego hangs from his neck like an anvil. He thinks he's going to think his way out of his chains, as if they were mere thoughts that contained him. He is tossing around Maharishi and Plato as if they were his allies rather than his jailers. By the time Laura makes it to the top of the wall again, I have figured out that I have to make a series of leaps with a constant tendency to the left in order to find a flat place to stop. Sadly, when I get there, a knife-throwing ninja and a blade-throwing machine cut poor, intrepid Laura to fish bait. Chris is intimidated by me. He's also a little wobbly on the ideas he's asserting. That's why he's behaving in this loud and assertive manner. If he were on a fast track to awakening, then it would be quite proper and fitting that he feel wobbly and threatened. he would be plunging headlong into the gnashing jaws of self-annihilation. But Chris isn't on a fast track. He's just stumbling through some conceptual challenges. The forest of delusion is treed with concepts, and all concepts amount to the same thing. You're still in the forest. Chris is wobbly and assertive because some small part of him knows that his exciting new discoveries do not mark the end of his journey, but the start of the real one. I set the controls to Laura aside and watch Chris as he continues to pull back the curtain and reveal the wizard. But instead of Chris and the steel-plated garment in which he is so inviolably wrapped, I see the goddess Maya, architect of this magnificent palace of delusion. She and I both sit listening to Chris. She smiles at me, and I smile back in wonder and admiration. We watch Chris expounding on freedom, even as his attachment to his ideas of freedom form the walls, floor, and ceiling of his cell. "How do you do it?" I ask Maya for the thousandth time, no less awed than the first. "Smoke and mirrors?" She smiles. "Layers," she says, as if that's the key to this seemingly impossible spectacle we behold. I understand. The only materials she has for the construction of this great edifice are veils so flimsy and transparent that they seem woven of nothing more than wisps of dream stuff. I suppose if that's all you have to work with, then you're going to learn a lot about creating in layers. Maya winks and is gone. I'm back with Chris and a fresh Laura, ready to begin the climb again. Chris is busily equating delusion with hell and bondage and evil and dark forces. Was I ever this tiresome? Oh, yes. Far worse, I'm sure. Laura makes it to the top again and is frantically shooting the ninja as her health reserves dwindle. But her valiant struggle is for naught. Dead again. "You need more firepower," says Chris. He's right. I start her again at the base of the wall climb. But this time, I change her weapon of choice from sissy pistols to Uzis and top off her health reserves just to be on the safe side. I make the climb and the tricky leaping grabs and pull up to the sloped floor and leap back and forth until I start taking knife hits from the ninja, but not from the blade-throwing machine, because I've stepped out of its line of fire. I pull the Uzis and shoot the ninja considerably more than it's absolutely necessary. Success! I save the game so that the next time I get her killed, I won't have to go through that particular ordeal again. Chris, in the meantime, has moved on to the subject of God. It sounds like Chris has a lot to say about God, some of it not entirely flattering. Well, at least he's heading in the right direction. I'm reminded of an amusing parable wherein a young student approaches the local guru and declares scornfully that he has thought about it and has decided that he is an atheist. The student is surprised that, rather than being shocked or angry, the teacher seems pleased. "What are you happy about?" demands the perplexed student. "I've just told you that I don't believe in God, so why do you smile?" "It means that you have started to think," the teacher replies. "Now keep thinking." I want to send Chris away, but I want to send him away with something to chew on. Problem is, Chris has his teeth clamped onto victimhood and dark overlords oppressing a spiritually hungry mankind or some such. I'm not concerned about his current level of understanding so much. That always changes. On this journey, if you aren't constantly disgusted by how naive and foolish you were just a few days ago, you've stalled. What I'd like Chris to do, however, has become a bit less rigid in his views, to not embrace them so tightly that he ends up spending undue amounts of time pinned under them. That's no small task, I know. Insights on the journey of awakening are hard-won treasures, but they must all be jettisoned eventually, and the sooner the better. The less we resist that releasing and the faster we seek the next treasure, the easier and less painful our progress. "Have you heard of Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters?" I ask. "You mean Electric Kool-Aid and all that? From the 60s?" "Right. And the Magic Bus. The first Magic Bus. Before the Who, before the Beatles." "Oh," says Chris flatly. "Cool." "You've probably seen pictures of the bus, or one like it. Very psychedelic. A real work of art. Should be in the Smithsonian," I muse. Chris is looking at me strangely, as if I have slipped out of phase with our conversation. "The name of the bus, you know, above the windshield where the destination sign goes, was Further." "Wow," says Chris, nodding, wondering if I'm done yet so he can continue his lecture on the insidious nature of duality. "Further," I repeat, gazing steadily into his eyes. "Why do you think they named it that?" "Well," he begins, wanting to have the answer, "I guess because they were traveling around in it, and they were saying, you know, onward, further, always more to see, somewhere else to go, the spirit of adventure." "Yes," I agree. "It's funny, though. For me, the word further was the single most important word in my own journey. It was like my mantra, but it had a very specific and poignant meaning. There were many times when the word further came to my aid, like when I'd think I had finally arrived someplace solid, someplace worth staying, and then I'd remember the word further, and what I understood further to really mean, and I'd realize that as much as I might like it where I was, I really wasn't where I was going yet." This is an oversimplification meant to soften Chris up a bit to the idea that where he is isn't where it's at. Even though I may have attained knowledge and understanding beyond my wildest hopes, even though I may have surpassed my highest expectations of what I might accomplish, even though I may have moved beyond many of my own mentors, the word further was always there, echoing in my mind, reminding me that there's only one objective of the journey, and that I wasn't there yet. I look to see if any of this is penetrating. Chris is nodding, indulging me, waiting for his turn to talk again. "Oh, well, at least Laura made it to the next level." Chapter 30. Even the poorest thing shines. My daily affairs are quite ordinary, but I'm in total harmony with them. I don't hold on to anything, don't reject anything, nowhere an obstacle or conflict. Who cares about wealth and honor? Even the poorest thing shines. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, drawing water and carrying wood. Layman Pang. It's around 1 in the morning, and the house is settled down for the night. I'm basically a night person, although I struggle with it. The problem is that my schedule seems to shift forward every night and day, so that one day I might be going to sleep at 4 in the afternoon and waking up at midnight, and a few days later I'm back to what the world considers a normal schedule, at least for a day or two. If I kept the hours I'm most comfortable with, I'd probably go to sleep at 4 a.m. and get up around noon regularly. That's the schedule I tend to stabilize at when I'm not trying to be normal. So now it's 1 in the morning, and I'm sitting in the living room, sorting through the books, seeing what's come in since I last spent time looking through the shelves. There are several thousand books in the shelves, most of them spiritually related to one degree or another, so that, as it happens, the place I most enjoy book browsing is in my own home. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, most of these books make me cringe with distaste and annoyance, and I have an urge to use them to fuel a huge bonfire. in the context of having a well-stocked spiritual library that is amusing to browse, I enjoy it. In the context of not further confusing students already punch drunk on bogus and conflicting spiritual knowledge, I want to make a pile and light a match. That, for example, is an interesting topic not addressed in a single one of these books that I know of. Context. How can anyone understand anything if they don't have a working grasp of context? And yet, I'd be willing to bet that few, if any, of these spiritually minded authors, even the most highly esteemed of them, address this simple tool of comprehension in simple, straightforward language. Small wonder, then, that the world is trying to wake itself up by going more deeply to sleep. It's no great surprise that no mind is considered synonymous with awake, or that truth is thought to be found through years of deprivation, or that desire and materialism have become the fashionable enemy of spiritual development. Nor is it any great surprise that Eastern teachings have been embraced in the West as methods of psychoanalysis, stress relief, and alternative medicine. Still, I keep thinking that spiritual aspirants, East and West, are going to someday awaken at least to the degree of realizing that, by any reasonable standards of success, the pursuit of spiritual awakening has proved to be the most abysmal failure in the history of man. The emperor has no clothes, and sooner or later everyone is going to see what's staring them right in the face. When that happens, perhaps there will be a major shift, a mass exodus away from the complexity and futility of all spiritual teachings. An exodus not outward toward Japan or India or Tibet, but inward, toward the self, toward self-reliance, toward self-determination, toward a common-sense approach to figuring out just what the hell's going on around here. A wiping of the slate. A fresh start. Sincere, intelligent people dispensing with the past and beginning anew, beginning by asking themselves, okay, where are we? What do we know for sure? What do we know that's true? A spiritual revolution. All nonsense, of course, and I know it, but that's the sort of drivel that runs through my head whenever I spend time examining what passes for spiritual wisdom in this world. Enlightenment, truth realization, is exactly the same for all beings in all times and all places. Any attempt to dress it up or to make it proprietary merely obscures it and makes it less accessible. Seeing exactly how obscured and inaccessible it has been made tends to frustrate me, at least for a few seconds, until I remember that everything's exactly as it should be and cannot, in fact, be otherwise. Maya has entered the room without my noticing. She stands behind the chair across from me, her hands resting on the seat back. "Do I exist?" she asks me. "Of course not," I reply. "Then how silly to get angry with me." "I know. All these books, all these teachers, all these organizations, they're all doing their job. Not so much as a hair out of place in the entire universe, as well you know." "Yes." She moves around the chair and sits down. We meet as former adversaries. She is supremely beautiful, I think. She is all the beauty of the world. "Would you prefer my other face?" she asks. "Either is fine." She smiles. She is endlessly beguiling. The pitter-patter of tiny feet pulls me out of our meeting, and I am surprised to find Annie bounding into my lap. She's dressed in a one-piece jammy thing with built-in feet and a bunny motif. She nestles into me, curls her legs up, and plants a thumb in her mouth. Her mother, Marla, is not far behind. She is in her nightgown. She apologizes for her daughter's intrusion, but I assure her that it's quite a welcome respite and invite her to take a seat. She explains that Annie napped too long this afternoon and has managed to disrupt her normal sleep rhythms. Marla goes to the kitchen to fix us some tea. Annie is snuggled in but still awake. I see she's wearing a necklace, so I pull it out and find a yin-yang pendant attached. "What's this?" I ask her. "Yin-yang," she replies. I laugh. "I think you're a yin-yang," I tell her. "I think you're a yin-yang," she rebuts. "No," I say in turn. "I'm pretty sure you're the yin-yang." Apparently I have crossed a line. She adjusts herself so that she can press her forehead firmly to mine, fixes me with her most solemn gaze, and assures me in no uncertain terms that if anyone is a yin-yang, it is indeed me. "Okay," I reply with equal solemnity. "I'm the yin-yang." She nods once and holds my gaze to let me know she means business. Finally satisfied, she curls back up in my lap, thumbs securely in mouth, and that's where we are when Marla returns with tea. There's a lap blanket draped over the top of the chair Annie and I are hunkered down in, so I grab it and lay it over her, tucking it in around the edges. Her mother notices the necklace. "I got that for her at a gift shop in town. She saw it and just had to have it." "Maybe she was Japanese in a previous life," I suggest. "Well," says Marla, "I think she wanted it because I have a yin-yang symbol tattooed here." She indicates the lowest region of abdomen that might still be politely referred to as abdomen, and she's seen it. I smile. "What was the thinking with the tattoo?" I asked. "Oh, you know, I was young. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to defy my parents. I wanted to demonstrate that I was in tune with the balanced nature of the universe, all that stuff. Since I've been here, though, in this house, I've heard people describe it differently than I thought. I think they're repeating things you've said. They make it sound more, I don't know, dark, I guess, but I'm not sure they understand it all that well either. I had planned to ask you about it, but not at 1 in the morning. "That's okay. It's certainly nothing sinister. As you know, the yin-yang symbol is generally viewed as representing the dual nature of reality, the equal and opposite nature of balancing forces, always in harmony, all that. But," she says, "but there's more. There's the third element." Marla's eyes shift to the necklace hanging from her daughter's neck. "What third element?" "Containment. The circle, the whole. Finiteness." Marla nods a little uncertainly. "Without the element of containment, the opposing elements could not exist, much less maintain their balance. The container is what defines the whole, of which black and white are the two aspects." Her look is asking why that matters. "That matters because duality is always finite. Duality is always contained, always within a finite sphere outside of which it cannot exist. It's the sphere that defines the context within which opposites exist. As an analogy, humans can't survive in outer space, so they need life support systems in which they can survive. Spacesuits and spaceships are like bubbles in which humans can exist, environmental bubbles conducive to human life within surroundings that aren't. Planet Earth is such a bubble. Bathyspheres and submarines are others." "So the circle represents the finiteness?" she asks. "The yin-yang symbol isn't the symbol of universal harmony and balance? It's a symbol of duality in the false universe?" "Well, it's both, I suppose, depending on your mood." "And what's outside the sphere? What's outside the bubble?"
"Exactly."
"Excuse me?" "That's the question. That's what all the spirituality stuff is about. What's ultimately true? Once you've arrived at the conclusion that reality as we think of it isn't reality at all, then the question becomes, what is? What's beyond the dualistic illusion? What's beyond context? Space, she guesses. Infinity? Sure. The truth is out there, the void, the abyss, no self, and our fragile little bubbles are what let us float around in the infinite, able to enjoy the experience of somethingness where only nothingness exists. The illusion of opposites, good and bad, love and hate, joy and sorrow, these aren't available out in infinite reality, only in bubbles. She mulls that over for a while. After a few minutes, she asks the question I've been nudging her toward. So why is nothingness better than somethingness? This is a big question. Why is unity better than duality? Why is truth better than the lie? Why is the infinite better than the finite? Why is awake better than dreaming? I never said it was, I respond. But Marla stares at me for a few moments, taken aback, assimilating. I smile as I watch her confusion. But I'm standing right on the edge, Marla. I'm in the bubble. I'm out of the bubble. Both, neither. But whatever I am not in the business of encouraging people to leave the bubble. I don't proselytize. I'm not selling anything. I'm not saying one thing is better than another. I simply stand here, both in and out, and try to aid those who come to me. Some will exit the bubble. Some will get a glimpse of the infinite, decide that that isn't what they wanted after all, and turn back. I don't try to stop them or convince them that truth is better. For those who have questions, I have answers, because I answered them all for myself. For those who want to proceed, I have guidance, because I made the journey. For those who make it through, I have advice, because I know what it is to be both within and without. But if you want to know what I really think, I think the bubble is a magnificent amusement park, and leaving it is a damn silly thing to do unless you absolutely must. And I would advise anyone who didn't absolutely have to leave to just head back in and enjoy it while it lasts, the good and the bad, the white and the black. Marla holds my gaze for several seconds. She knows what she's just been told, but she's having trouble processing it. Annie is sound asleep now. Marla comes and picks her up without waking her, and whispers, "Thank you." After they go, I let my mind continue playing with the whole bubbles in infinity monologue. Needs some fine-tuning, I decide. My mind floats back to my earlier thoughts and my unceasing amazement that something as seemingly simple and inevitable as truth has been utterly mired in confusion and misdirection. I am not surprised to see that Maya, goddess of confusion and misdirection, is back in the chair opposite me. "So who are the priests of all religions?" she asks me. "They are your shepherds," I respond, "keeping the sheep in the fold, away from the cliffs." I know this. I know that the religions with their promises of an afterlife form an interior layer of containment, and that the eternal rewards and punishments they speak of are as finite as the one in which they speak. Bubbles within bubbles. Turtles on top of turtles. "And who are the saints and sages of the great spiritual traditions?" she asks. "They are your final level of containment. They are the weavers of the final web, masters of subtle misdirection, convincing because they are convinced. For every million that get near the edge, perhaps only one steps over." She smiles. "And where do I dwell?" "In the heart," I respond, "in fear." "Fear of what?" she asks. "Fear of being haunted by meddlesome Hindu deities?" I ask. But she's already gone. Chapter 31. Selections from Song of Myself, Walt Whitman. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end, but I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses, and to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Have you heard that it was good to gain the day? I also say it is good to fall. Battles are lost in the same spirit in which they are won. I exist as I am. That is enough. If no other in the world be aware, I sit content. And if each and all be aware, I sit content. One world is aware, and by far the largest to me, and that is myself. And whether I come to my own today, or in 10,000 or 10,000,000 years, I can cheerfully take it now, or with equal cheerfulness, I can wait. Have you outstripped the rest? Are you the president? It is a trifle. They will more than arrive there, everyone, and still pass on. I know perfectly well my own egotism, know my omnivorous lines and must not write any less, and would fetch you, whoever you are, flush with myself. The clock indicates the moment, but what does eternity indicate? All forces have been steadily employed to complete and delight me. Now, on this spot, I stand with my robust soul. Each man and each woman of you I lead upon a knoll, my left hand hooking you round the waist, my right hand pointing to landscapes of continents and the public road. Not I, not anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself. It is not far. It is within reach. Perhaps you have been on it since you were born and did not know. Perhaps it is everywhere, on water and on land. Shoulder your duds, dear son, and I will mine, and let us hasten forth. Wonderful cities and free nations we shall fetch as we go. If you tire, give me both burdens, and rest the chuff of your hand on my hip, and in due time you shall repay the same service to me, for after we start, we never lie by again. This day before dawn I ascended a hill, and looked at the crowded heaven, and I said to my spirit, when we become the enfolders of those orbs, and the pleasure and knowledge of everything in them, shall we be filled and satisfied then? And my spirit said, no, we but level that lift to pass and continue beyond. You are also asking me questions, and I hear you. I answer that I cannot answer. you must find out for yourself. Sit a while, dear son. Here are biscuits to eat, and here is milk to drink. But as soon as you sleep and renew yourself in sweet clothes, I kiss you with a good-bye kiss and open the gate for your egress hence. Long enough have you dreamed contemptible dreams. Now I wash the gum from your eyes. You must habit yourself to the dazzle of the light and of every moment of your life. Long have you timidly waited, holding a plank by the shore. Now I will you to be a bold swimmer, to jump off in the midst of the sea, rise again, nod to me, shout, and laughingly dash with your hair. I am the teacher of athletes. He that by me spreads a wider breast than my own proves the width of my own. He most honors my style, who learns under it to destroy the teacher. I teach straying from me, yet who can stray from me? I follow you, whoever you are, from the present hour. My words itch at your ears till you understand them. And I say to mankind, be not curious about God, for I who am curious about each am not curious about God. No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death. I hear and behold God in every object, yet understand God not in the least. Nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and everyone is signed by God's name, and I leave them where they are, for I know that wherever so I go, others will punctually come forever and ever. There is that in me. I do not know what it is, but I know it is in me. Wretched and sweaty, calm and cool, then my body becomes, I sleep long. I do not know it. It is without name. It is a word unsaid. It is not in any dictionary, utterance, symbol. Something it swings on more than the earth I swing on. To it the creation is the friend whose embracing awakes me. Perhaps I might tell more. Outlines I plead from my brothers and sisters. Do you see, O my brothers and sisters? It is not chaos or death. It is form, union, plan. It is eternal life. It is happiness. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I, too, am not a bit tamed. I, too, am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you. Chapter 32. Who is to judge? Understand this, if nothing else. Spiritual freedom and oneness with the Tao are not randomly bestowed gifts, but the rewards of conscious self-transformation and self-evolution. The Hua Hu Ching. I spend the next morning sitting in front of my computer. A cold front has moved in, making it too chilly and windy to do anything outside. So it's a good opportunity to take care of some inside work, which, for me, means writing this book and catching up on some email correspondence. Answering email questions from students would be my full-time job if I tried to provide an in-depth response to every question they come up with. I don't. I don't even read their emails that closely, really, just close enough to get the idea. It's the same way I do it in person. The simple fact is that while there may be millions of questions, there are probably only 100 or so answers.
And, ultimately, only one. One.
My job isn't really to answer the questions directly, and I seldom do. Ironically, students aren't really qualified to ask questions, and if I simply answered the questions they felt the need to ask, then they'd only manage to deepen their own entrenchment in their false beliefs. That's why it might seem like I never give a straight answer to a straight question. Rather, I use the question, or the first few words of the question, to determine the next thing the student needs to hear. The student has no idea what the next thing they need to hear might be, but I know exactly what it is, because I'm looking down from an elevation that lets me see exactly where they are, where they want to be, and where they have to go to get there. It's all perfectly clear to me, but because they don't have that overview, students cannot effectively chart their own course. That's the role of the teacher. Otherwise, everyone would just pick up a book and, as Jolene puts it, bam! The students ask for a fish. I hand them a worm. They may not be thrilled with a worm, but that's the only way it's going to work. On this path, you fight for every step. No one goes with you, and no one can do it for you. It cannot be otherwise. I generally answer email questions with a question or a reference to a resource that might help the student develop their question more fully, which often leads to resolution. For instance, a question might mention Hitler. When Hitler appears in the question, it usually means that the asker is struggling with the concepts of good and evil. When Hitler and God show up in the same question, then it's the love of God that can't be reconciled with the horrors and suffering that one finds on earth. A lifetime of being told that God is a God of love is near the heart of the conflict. Of course, such is only half a God, or a third, but it's not really about God anyway. I might suggest that a person at this juncture rent and watch the Peter Brook version of the Mahabharata on video, and pay special attention to the many facets of Krishna, and especially Peter Brook's own introduction to one of the segments where he points out Krishna's seemingly ungodlike behavior and asks the viewer poignantly, "Who's to judge?" My hope in sending students in that direction is that they might manage to broaden their own limited definition of God. Krishna cheats, lies, murders, and is cowardly at various times throughout the great epic. And that's something that anyone coming from a God's a jolly good fellow mindset might have trouble processing. Krishna, however, is not a God of love and light. He represents the whole thing. So in him, all qualities must be found. A God of love and goodness would be merely a single aspect of a God who is defined as absolute. Krishna is the personification of the absolute. So if you leave a child molester or genocidal maniac or puppy kicker out of him due to your own delicate sensibilities, then you've redefined him as something finite, and we must come up with a new name for the absolute. And so, of course, the more interesting issue brings us back to Peter Brook's insightful question, who is to judge? It's not a definition of God that's being demolished by this query. It's one's own place in the universe, one's own relationship to the Absolute. This is an important step in understanding that it's all one thing. Or, more accurately, it's an important step away from the belief that it's not. I would make it clear to the student asking the original question that there was no hurry, that they should take their time and develop their thoughts to fullness. I might suggest that they process their understanding by writing an essay for me in which they attempt to answer their own question, cautioning them that they must be very thoughtful and rewrite it again and again until they have it exactly the way they want it before sending it to me. I'd never see it, though, because that level of scrutiny leaves no trace of the original question. Oscar Wilde wrote, "All thought is immoral. Its very essence is destruction. If you think of anything, you kill it. Nothing survives being thought of." What he might have meant is that falseness exists only in shadow. Illumination by intellect destroys the untrue by revealing that there was never anything there to begin with. Just as light banishes shadow, scrutiny banishes illusion. The debate over free will versus predetermination provides a particularly good example of this teaching process. Students are perplexed by this question because they focus on an answer when all their attention should remain on the question. "Stay with the question," I tell them. "Don't worry about the answer. Just get the question right. Examine your assumptions." Soon enough, the question itself has been destroyed, and along with it, many layers of delusion. Students, understandably, wish to deepen their understanding, but it is the role of the teacher to keep them moving forward rather than standing around deepening things. Self-realization isn't about more. It's about less. The only construction required for awakening is that which facilitates demolition. Actually, I often don't reply to the email and letters sent to me at all because it is clear that the writing is the process and that no response is required. I'm being used as the target recipient in a process of spiritual autolysis in which my only role is to exist as an ideal in the student's mind. This can be a very intense and accelerated process. It is not uncommon for a writer to send me a message every day apologizing for the one they sent the day before, embarrassed that they could have been so foolish, and enthusiastically sharing their newfound level of comprehension, which, if all goes well, will be tomorrow's source of embarrassment. Still, handling email takes time, and I can only take care of 3 or 4 per hour. This morning I managed to respond to a dozen before I get too fuzzy-brained to continue. I turn off the computer and step out of my office and right into Jolene's butt. "Oh, hello, Jolene's butt," I say wittily. She turns and looks up at me. "Oh, hi. I wasn't sure if you were up here. You're so quiet." She's on all fours with a bucket and a brush, scrubbing the oak floor of the main upstairs hallway. Most of the floor is still wet, so there's no point in trying to go past her. I plunk down on the floor, back against the wall. I like watching other people work. "How's it going?" I ask. "Great," she says exuberantly. "I went to the library and read Plato's cave allegory and some commentaries on it. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what we discussed." "Which was?" The difference between mysticism and enlightenment." She has stopped working to talk. I indicate the uncleaned part of the floor. "I can't authorize a break." She giggles and resumes scrubbing. "I wonder why you and I might have been discussing the difference between enlightenment and mysticism," I say. "Well," she explains, "we were talking about Yamamoto Roshi and Plato's cinema." "Yeah, I remember all that." I just can't remember why I would think that this was a particularly relevant topic for you. Zen. Ah, Zen. We were talking about the differences between the Zen that sells books and the Zen that leads to enlightenment. Dang, I exclaim. That's a pretty interesting topic. What did we come up with? Well, we were talking about Plato's cinema and the difference between enlightenment and mysticism. Yeah, right, because I think you were saying, trying to show me that the books and everything I was reading about Zen... So, the Zen that sells books is about mysticism, and real Zen is about enlightenment. I don't know, she says. I mean, yeah, real Zen is about enlightenment, isn't it? Yes, I know that, but I don't know if the Zen that sells books is about mysticism, or if it's just, you know, selling books. I guess I didn't think this part through very good.
Did you think about the cinema part?
She lights up. Yes, and I know the answer. Mystics stay in the theater, but the theater isn't the whole thing. It's not the final, total, most ultimate thing. Enlightenment isn't in the theater. If you want to be enlightened, you have to go up the aisle and out the exit to the sunlight and totally leave the theater. Leave the theater, I mused. That's interesting. So everybody's sitting there watching the movie... The cows, she blurted out. That's what happened to me in church. I stopped believing that the movie was really reality. That's when I undid my chains and I stood up and saw all the people I knew still sitting there, just like you said. But you haven't read Plato's Cave in a long time because your version is way funny. She has stopped scrubbing again.
Maybe it's Plato's version that's way funny. Keep scrubbing.
Yeah, I haven't read it in a long time. So you're saying the mystics are in the theater? Yeah, she says. But the rest of the theater isn't reality. It's just a different part of the whole fake thing. It's more real than the movie, but it's still not really real. And the mystics know that? She doesn't blurt out the answer to this, just continues working the brush in small circles. I think I hear her humming. But then I realize she's humming. No, she says in the hushed tone of one who has just unmasked a secret plot. They don't. That's it, isn't it? They're a little more awake, but they're still not awake because they think they're, like, totally awake. But they're still in the theater, like the light on the screen. The light in the projector isn't the real source either. It's just a tiny spark of the true light. The sun.
That's what I read.
So the people in chains watching the movie are like asleep, even though they don't know it. But so are the people who aren't chained anymore. Oh, wow. Like me. And maybe the mystics are the most awake of all, or maybe whoever is the most mystical is the most awake. But if they knew about the sun, about the light in the projector just being a tiny spark... then they wouldn't be in the theater. They'd be heading out. So then, they don't know either, really. Wow, I think I'm really starting to get this.
So you're sitting here telling me you're not awake. That must be pretty weird for you.
'Cause I asked you, in the park, at the lake, I asked you why you said you weren't a mystic. That's why. You're not in the theater. That's the difference. You kept going. You're out in the sunlight, in the real source.
She has stopped scrubbing again.
That's what awake means. That's what enlightened means.
If you're not going to do the floor, then I'll have to. She starts scrubbing again.
I don't know much about what mystics are all about, she continues, but that's the whole thing. No matter how great a mystic guy you are, no matter how great everyone thinks you are, if you're still in the theater...
I don't think you can talk and scrub at the same time.
If Sonea came up and saw the job you're doing...
She redoubles her efforts. If you're still in the theater, you're still not awake. You're still asleep, but, like, you're dreaming that you're awake.
You still don't know what reality is, like the sun. The theater is like a dream, and... So a mystic, or anyone like me who's not a mystic but not in chains either, it's something, but it's not the thing. Okay, I say. So, I'm enlightened, and that means I'm outside the theater. And the sun?
Oh, yeah,
she answers tentatively. But here I am, talking to you.
Yeah.
I wonder if I had to go through all the levels to get out. You know, first step out of the chains like you did in church, then become a little mystical, then more, until I finally became so totally mystical that I left the theater entirely. See what I mean? Did I develop and evolve spiritually inside the theater? Or did I just go straight for that path and out into the sunlight? She turns her attention to the floor while her mind chews on the question. It's no small question. Does one achieve truth realization in stages, or in a single step like the fool of the tarot deck taking a leap into the void? And, if the latter, how many steps are involved in becoming the fool that takes the leap?
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! That's what you're saying! That's your point! This whole thing started with you saying you're not a mystic. You said I'd be disappointed because you weren't a very mystical guy. Can you do that? Can you just go right out without doing the whole mystical thing?
Boy, she shines when she's happy. Good question, I reply. Offhand, I don't know. I did a bit of mystical stuff. I had experiences of undifferentiated consciousness, mystic union, on several occasions, and it had a big effect on me. So I can't say from personal experience that someone could just head right out. Get back to work. She does. I can certainly say that you don't have to rise up through the mystical ranks or progressively more refined levels of consciousness to finally graduate into the sunlight. And if I were to guess, I'd say there's no reason you couldn't do it without having first been dipped in the divine. No reason that I can think of, anyway. Of course, that's in the space of a single lifetime. Who knows what development may have occurred through numerous incarnations. But this isn't the time for all that, and the fact remains that I am not a very mystical guy.
This was so cool! Is this how it always works? I ask you these questions, and I don't even think you answered them. You just somehow showed me how to answer them myself. Is that, like, your method? Is it always like this?
I don't know. Hang around and find out for yourself.
This is really cool. I really had a total blast going to the library and figuring all this out. It's like I was on a mission or something. I got obsessed, and it was great. I really feel like I'm learning something important. I've never really felt like that before. I've always done well in school, but I never learned anything I thought of as, like, important.
Yeah, great. You've done well in school. You're learning important stuff. You're a student of Plato and all that. But this floor looks like you wiped it with a muddy sock. Didn't those Zen books at least teach you anything about being mindful in tasks?
What's my next thing? She asks, completely ignoring my criticism. Do I get another assignment now? Or like another question I have to work on? What do I do now, besides the floor?
Well, I don't really have anything prepared. I'll have to give it some thought.
So, anyway, according to this little theory of yours, do you think Yamamoto Roshi is enlightened? Or just a mystic?
She begins, but stops herself.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I have to think about it.
Atta girl.
Chapter 33. No self is true self. The man in whom Tao acts without impediment, does not bother with his own interests, and does not despise others who do.
He does not struggle to make money and does not make a virtue of poverty. He goes his way without relying on others and does not pride himself on walking alone. While he does not follow the crowd, he won't complain of those who do. Rank and reward make no appeal to him. Disgrace and shame do not deter him. He is not always looking for right and wrong, always deciding yes and no. The ancients said, therefore, the man of Tao remains unknown. Perfect virtue produces nothing. No self is true self, and the greatest man is nobody. Chuang Tzu. Chapter 34. The point of the ride is the ride. My barn having burned to the ground, I can now see the moon. Taoist saying. I did give Jolene her next assignment. It was a simple one. Next time we speak, I told her, let's do it without the cave theater analogy. Try to explain all this stuff to me in the most unadorned terms. And when she shows up ready to do it, I'll let her proceed, but not for me. I'll have her explain it to someone who's not already familiar with it. When she's done, she'll possess a clear understanding of the difference between being asleep within the cave, being awake within the cave, and being out of the cave. And if that's all she ever gets from her time with me, then she'll at least be literate enough to order off the spiritual menu for the rest of her life. I make my way downstairs looking for some lunch. As usual, the fridge is stocked with leftovers that have somehow improved with age. I grab some sib pulao, apple rice, and a masala dosa, and make a plate, which I nuke for a minute before spooning on some pear chutney. Kings and princes don't eat this well. I eat standing up in the kitchen. The house is surprisingly quiet. A few of the gang stick their heads in and say hello or ask for help clarifying some point or another. Question: why am I always so dissatisfied? Why can't I ever just be content? Answer: you weren't born to be content. Your discontent is the engine that drives you. Be grateful to it. Question: what does it mean if I saw a blue pearl during meditation? Answer: it means you saw a blue pearl during meditation. Question: where's the cream? Answer: top shelf behind the juice. But for the most part, the house is unusually silent. I don't think there's anything special going on. It's just one of those low-energy days. Everybody's probably lying around, taking naps, reading, keeping to themselves. In fact, I don't know what to do with myself. I don't feel like sitting in front of the computer. I don't feel like sitting in front of the TV. I don't feel like reading. I don't feel like taking a nap. I don't feel like going anywhere. Okay, I guess I'll just stand here. Eventually, Julie makes her way in. She tells me she spent the morning in the living room just looking through the books and reading this and that. I'm glad to see her, although I notice that she seems a little frayed. She asks about continuing the interview, which I'm happy to do. She goes to find her purse where her tape recorder and notes are. When she returns, she clips the mic to my shirt front, and I stick the little recorder in my pocket after she turns it on. Ready? She asks. Yes, ma'am. Okay, she says, consulting her notes and leaning into my collar to speak. Question 12. Jesus said, stop, I say. She does. I don't do that. I don't respond to statements like that. I don't because I can't. We don't know what Jesus said, why he said it, or if there even was a Jesus. Now, if Jesus comes into the kitchen right now and starts talking, I can handle it. I can deal with him. I can hold my own with anyone on this subject. What I can't deal with is any statement that begins with, some book says that some dead guy said, see what I'm saying? Julie nods.
Make sense?
Yes, she says. It makes perfect sense. I'm surprised I've never heard anyone say it before.
In the process of waking yourself up, you quickly realize that there's no outside authority. You have to verify everything yourself. If you adopt something someone else said, it's only after you have verified it for yourself. If Jesus, Buddha, or Lao Tzu made it, you can make it. There's no choice about this. You can't walk in someone else's shoes, and there are no turnkey solutions.
Question 13. She smiles. Question 13. We touched on belief last time we spoke, and you said that you don't operate at the level of belief. Did you mean that you don't have any faith or beliefs?
Not a bad question. I can see where readers might wonder, but I have to think about who I'm really speaking for, about what's really going on here. Someone in my position never encounters an impartial observer, and nothing I say is ever really about me. The answer isn't that I am or am not a person of faith or belief.
End of Disc 7.